I'm Tavis Smiley. Welcome to the second hour of our program today. Delighted to have you tuned in. In this hour, his passion for systemic change is driven by his abiding love for his wife, Kira, who passed away following the birth of their second child. Kira underwent a routine C-section following an uncomplicated pregnancy. But hours later, she died from internal hemorrhaging despite adamant pleas for help from medical professionals by her husband and other loved ones. Kira's story exemplifies the current crisis in America, rising rates of black maternal mortality, and the silencing of black voices. I am delighted and honored and humbled that he has given us an hour to trek through what I know must be a painful conversation every time he has it. But let me start by thanking Charles Johnson IV for joining us for the hour to talk about Kira and this story. Charles, good to have you on. Thank you for your time, sir.
Oh, brother, listen, first and foremost, I'm just so grateful to be here. And I know that, you know, we've got an hour to work with. Before I say anything, I just have to take a moment, man, and just thank you. I won't even say Tavis, I'll say Mr. Smiley, for just being who you are and who you've been for our community for so many years, brother. So, you know, I came up watching you on BET. I came up with the state of Black America. And so these things, it really truly is been a conversation that I have been really looking forward to, brother. So with that, I'm really excited to explore this issue with you, and thank you for making this topic a priority.
No, you are kind. That means a great deal to hear that from you. I'm humbled every time I hear those kinds of sentiments and accolades. I say all the time that every one of us wants to be loved, appreciated, acknowledged, and affirmed, whether you admit it or not.
Amen.
You
know,
we all want
Amen.
Those things. That's part of the human condition, and it means something.
Amen.
When you spend a life trying to love and serve people, that people get that, and it's never lost to me. I am always deeply touched and humbled by those kinds of sentiments. So thank you for sharing that. It means a great deal.
As I said
a moment ago, I'm grateful. I can't imagine what it was like to endure what you endured. I know that one never closes on a loved one like you close on a house. So I know that it must be difficult and painful to discuss this every time, but thank you for giving us this hour. Let me provide a little bit more context here, because sure. I want to just be transparent, as you will be, of course, as we move through this hour. So if you're in Los Angeles, the hospital that we're talking about is Cedars, known around the world, but Cedars messed this up. And it's not just Cedars. So we're going to talk about what happened to Kira in this hour. But rest assured, there are other hospitals all across this country who are guilty of the same sorts of, I don't want to say infraction, that's not a serious enough term. But when you lose too many black women in childbirth, after childbirth, because of mistakes made by institutions, by hospitals, it's a problem. I want to talk about it in this hour. And again, I thank Charles for sharing with us the story. So that said, let me pass the mic to you. I want to start with this first, because I want to make sure that we understand who Kira was before we get to what they did to Kira. Tell me about Kira.
Man, I appreciate that. And even, you know, 8 years later, even when I prepare to do my best to articulate who this woman was, man. We're talking about a woman that, you know, spoke five languages fluently, right? She had her pilot's license. She was an avid skydiver. I joke and I say, man, look, she went skydiving like some of us go for jobs, right? She was a thrill seeker. I've never seen anybody squeeze more out of 24 hours in a day than she would. You know, just this infectious personality and smile who never met a stranger. And honestly, like I say, you know, she challenged me to be a better person, a better man in every single aspect of my life. And I'll be frank, you know, like, she was way out of my league. You know what I'm saying? And the best decision I ever made was making this woman my wife.
Mm. She's out of your league, but maybe not, because you chose her, but she also chose you. Tell me about your courtship, how you guys met. I want to get the backstory about your time together, man.
That's cool, and I don't get a chance to tell this part of the story often. So we were at a mutual friend's birthday party, and I was on my way out, and I'd ridden with some other friends, and my buddy was driving, and so we were headed out. And as I was walking towards the exit, you know, everybody was doing their thing, and I just see this just beautiful young lady sitting there, but she is has her arms folded and this look on her face like she is not feeling this. Like she is not feeling this. Like this is not her spot. Like she's beyond ready to go. And she just looks so out of place because everybody was having such a good time. Mm-hmm. And this isn't even, I gotta be honest, this is not in my you know, you say in my bag, right? This is not something that I don't know what came over me. I will never forget. At the moment, Frankie Beverly, Before I Let You Go was playing, right? And so it's playing in the room. You know, that's the vibe of all vibes. And as I'm approaching her, right, we make eye contact. She still has that look on her face. But then I just start singing it to her as I'm walking. And her eyes just lit up in this smile, right? Everything that those arms folded, that kind of like that whole posture, it just kind of faded away. And this it was replaced by this. The most beautiful smile I have ever seen, right? And oh my goodness. So, you know, we chatted briefly, but once again, you know, it's like you and your boys are running. Come on, we got to roll. And I was like, look, you know, here's my face. Can we, you know, I'd love to get in touch with you. And I think a couple of days later, we did lunch, and the rest was history somewhat, right? Mm-hmm. And so what started with really just a friendship, man, you know, around 2005 and 2006, and then Kira, actually, interestingly enough, went to China for a trip that was supposed to be 2 weeks and ended up staying for 3.5 years.
Hold that thought. That's why you said the rest is history, kind of, because Kira disappeared for 3.5 years in China. I'm learning more about the backstory of Kira. We'll get to the part, the sad part of this story. And then after the sad part, we'll talk about the work that Charles is doing today in honor of Kira. So the story is going to ebb and flow. It's going to be a roller coaster of emotion, but we're going to get through this together. You're listening to Charles Johnson IV, and I'm glad about it on Tavis Smiley.
This is getting good.
Yeah, man.
Tavis Smiley. Continues when we come forward.
I wanted to pull this up because you're telling us an amazing love story about you and Kira. And you mentioned that when y'all saw each other for the first time, this was the vibe y'all were hearing. Turn it up, Miles. Turn it up.
Crank it up.
So you were saying, Charles, a moment ago, that the rest, as they say, is history. But then you said, not really. Finish telling me this love story of how Kira disappeared on you for 3.5 years.
Man, she disappeared on me, man. You playing that, man. And just thank you to your team for playing that. I'm over here cheesing like a pizza, man. but, you know, so she ends up going, you know, the adventure that she was. She goes to China for a week for a trip that's supposed to be 2 weeks and ends up staying for 3.5 years, right? And, you know, she ended up, you know, establishing businesses in China, and she had an education background. And so she actually opened up English second language schools in China, teaching Chinese children English. And she spent some time, and then, you know, I, you know, enjoyed the life of being a young bachelor in Atlanta. And then when she moved back, we just kind of picked up where we left off and, you know, just kind of began this amazing partnership together. And yeah, man, it was an amazing journey together.
Yeah. So you guys got together and you had one child, correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So I always wanted to be a dad. And so in 2014 we welcomed our first son, Charles the Fifth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so right.
Let me just probe that. I mean, you said something a moment ago that sounds simple on the surface, but there's so much there. There's so much there.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a black man saying, I always wanted to be a dad. I always wanted to be a dad. Unpack that for me, Charles. Why'd you always want to be a dad?
So I just, you know, for me, fatherhood was cool, man. And you know, my father, and this is not, and I'm just trying to be careful about how I do. My father is a good man, right, with noble intentions. However, he was somebody that was very focused on his career and being a provider, right. Mm-hmm. And so the things that I longed for as a kid, oftentimes weren't there. And that's like I said, I'm being very careful about how I phrase this. But I always looked up to my friends who had the dad that coached the team, right. Mm-hmm. That was shooting hoops. And that wasn't something that my dad, that just wasn't my dad's thing. And so I knew very early on the type of father I wanted to be. And, you know, I just always wanted that, man. And so when that became a reality, man, you couldn't tell me nothing. I was ecstatic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking about what it means, though, to be a part of a Black family lineage, a Black family heritage, where you're now up to Charles V.
It's real. It's real. And that's something that, you know, I'll just be transparent. We're talking to families. I think that, you know, I went through a period in my life where me and my father's relationship wasn't the best. Mm-hmm. And I went through this thing, this phase of, you know, I was going to stop this, man. Like, I'm never going to name my son Charles, right? Because of where I was in that space and time. Mm-hmm. But as I got older, I began to realize that everything about that lineage made me who I was, mm-hmm. right? Whether I liked it or not. And it was with intention for me to break those generational curses and to be intentional about redirecting it and carry on something, because the opportunity to have somebody carry a name for five generations, like you said, in our community, mm-hmm. is something that is so significant and so special. And how dare I not honor that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, as you were talking, I'm thinking about that great writer, Shakespeare, who asked that probing and provocative question, what's in a name? A rose by any other name would still smell just as sweet. With all due respect to Mr. Shakespeare, there's a whole lot in a name. And when you carry it for five generations, it means something, particularly in the Black community. So we celebrate all of you Charleses, and even Charles V. Let me just ask right quick, how is Charles V doing all these years later?
He's doing great, man. So my boys now, we'll talk about Langston as well, are 8 and 9 years old, mm-hmm. and they're smart. They are funny. They are determined. They are kind. And you know, they're venturesome, and you know, they really, and that's why I tell brothers, choose wisely, man. They really have all of their mother's, you know, all of their mother's best characteristics, man. They're doing exceptionally well, particularly under the circumstances of what they've been through.
Yeah. I heard you say his name is Langston. Should I read into that? Langston?
Yeah. You're a historian and definitely, you know, a fan of literature, particularly African-American literature.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we talked about, and we talked just, I think it's important for this conversation to kind of lean into the legacy part of this, and that my great-grandfather, Charles Spurgeon Johnson, the first, and the Langston Hughes were actually good friends. Mm. And so that was the carryover of that legacy. You know, it was important for us to celebrate, you know, Mr. Hughes. And also, it's also this tough thing. We never wanted Langston to feel that his brother was the one that only was tied to a legacy, right? Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to be able to immediately not have him search for greatness associated with who he was, right? And so, you know, the brother sit here, you know, even at 3 years old, he was, you know, he can recite poetry, and he can talk to you about, you know, him going to Lincoln University. He can tell you all the things about the great Langston Hughes, man. So we really make sure that we celebrate that legacy, and it's at the forefront of how we shape and we mold the boys.
Man, I got goosebumps with that story, man. You and Kira done good, man. Y'all done good. For him to know that his name means something, and for him at this age to already be able to unpack that for people, what his name means and where that name comes from, and the fact that Langston Hughes was a friend of his family. It's a powerful story in and of itself. And I ask these questions not knowing what the answers are going to be, obviously. I never know where these conversations are going to go, but I think I'm asking all the right questions in this conversation. I'm asking all the right questions.
We're on the road.
Yeah, I'm doing
awesome. That's the importance of being here with you, because I have opportunities to share the story, but I don't get to share these aspects of our story. Does that make sense?
It does.
So I'm honored to have this conversation.
No, man, I thank you for taking these questions. So you and Kira get together. Charles V comes along, and then you get pregnant with your second baby. Take it from there.
Yeah. So, you know, we once we had Charles, we kind of began to talk about how cool it would be to have these back-to-back boys, right? You know, brothers that were close in age, And we did the whole politically correct thing the first time around. It was like, you know what? We don't care what the gender is. We just gonna, you know, we just gonna just give it a healthy child. But the second go round, particularly Kira, was she was clear that she was a boy's mama. She grew up the youngest sister with three older brothers, right? She was an avid sports fan. She didn't see herself doing hair and nails and tea parties. She liked this idea of, you know, soccer games and, you know what I'm saying, and t-ball and all the things that come with raising young men. And so when we found out we were welcoming a second son in April of 2016 and that they would be 18 months apart, this was it, man. Mm-hmm. Like, this was it. And we were just so thrilled to find out that God was blessing us with another little boy.
Yeah. And this is where the story turns. As I mentioned earlier, she underwent a routine C-section following an uncomplicated pregnancy. Take the story from there, Charles, if you will, sir.
Sure. As you mentioned, you know, throughout Kira's entire pregnancy, she was not only in good health, but she was in exceptional health. Every single prenatal visit pointed to both her and Langston being exceptionally healthy. And so we are both natives of Atlanta, and we've recently relocated to Los Angeles. And the painful irony, particularly for your listeners there in Southern California, is that, you know, as a father, as a husband, you want the best for your family. And so I sought out what I truly thought and what we truly thought was the best place. And we made the intentional decision to give birth at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles because it was our understanding that this was the place, right? It was this fancy hospital in Beverly Hills. It's where everybody goes. And particularly, they're supposed to have this reputation of excellence, particularly in the area of labor and obstetrics. So on April 12th of 2016...
Charles, pardon the interruption. You chose Cedars. Where were you living at the time?
So we were in Los Angeles. Okay. We had relocated from Atlanta to Los Angeles. Okay, so we've been in Los Angeles.
Got it.
Yes.
So you're already in L.A. and you chose
Cedars.
We're
in L.A., yes,
okay,
sir.
Keep going. I'm sorry.
Exactly. So Charles was born in Atlanta and Langston. We had moved after Charles was born to Los Angeles. And so we seek out Cedars, and we're intentional about that. And so on April 12th of 2016, we went into Cedars-Sinai for what we expected to be a routine cesarean delivery it was a scheduled cesarean at our doctor's recommendation. So we go in at 2 p.m. for the delivery, right? Langston is born perfectly healthy, 10 fingers, 10 toes, you know, came out super handsome, right? Looking just like me. I joke, like, you know.
Looking just like his daddy.
Just like me, right?
Yeah.
Just like his daddy. So I'm just on top of the world, right? And so they take us back to recovery, which is typical in a cesarean delivery. And as I'm sitting there soaking it all in, the pride of being a father for the second time, Kira's there resting and Langston's in a little toaster incubator thing, right? And I'm just sitting there watching both of them rest. And I'm just soaking it in, just that pride of becoming a father. I know you know it well. This is around 4 o'clock. I'm going to take you all through the timeline of events briefly and in the interest of time. Mm-hmm. As I look down, I begin to see blood coming from the catheter at Kira's bedside, right? Keep in mind, this is around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I bring it to the attention of the doctors and the staff at Cedars. They come in, they examine Kira, they take her vitals, they order some tests, but very importantly, they order a CT scan that's supposed to be performed stat. So for you, Tavis, and for your listeners, what does stat mean to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
It means right now,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
at this point, I'm concerned, but I'm thinking my baby is healthy, my wife is healthy, and we're at Cedars-Sinai, right? That's 4 o'clock. 5 o'clock comes. Her blood work comes back. It's showing that it's abnormally low. She's sensitive to the touch. You know, she's complaining of pain in her abdomen. And so there's very clear signs early on that she's hemorrhaging significantly internally. All right. But still no CT scan. Mm. Keep in mind that CT scan was ordered stat. Right. So 6 o'clock comes.
Mm.
No CT scan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm continuing to ask, hey, where's the CT scan? What's going on? They're saying, oh, we'll see. We're not sure. We'll let you know. 7 o'clock comes. No CT scan. Right. And I'm still asking more and more adamantly now that by this time, Tavis, she's shivering uncontrollably, right? Because she's losing so much blood. And I'm saying, look, what's going on, saying, oh, well, we're not sure. We may take her back for surgery. And so this game of dismissal, denial, and very importantly, deprioritization continues to escalate. 8 o'clock, no CT scan. I'm still advocating. My family is there asking, begging, pleading for them to do something. 9 o'clock comes in. Now, 9 o'clock, Kira's still there. The only thing they've done to this point is give her IV fluids.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. It's 9 o'clock. It's been happening since 2. It's now 9 o'clock, and all they're doing is giving her fluids. The rest of the story when we come forward with Charles Johnson IV on Tavis Smiley.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward. Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
Oh, Lord. It's difficult conducting conversations when you know where the story is headed. And yet, Charles Johnson IV is telling this story in a way that is resonant for me, and I can tell by all of you posting on our social media platforms, it's resonating with you as well. Charles Johnson IV, it is now 9 o'clock. Pick up the story, sir.
Yes, sir. So 9 o'clock. As I mentioned before the break, all they've done to this point is give her IV fluids. And at this point, a nurse comes in to change Kira's IV fluids. And as she's exiting the room, I followed her, and just kind of out of desperation, I pulled her to the side and I said to her, look, ma'am, I looked her in her eyes, I grabbed her by both hands, and I said, look, my wife is not doing well. They said that they were going to take her back for a CT scan. That was hours ago. Nobody has come. They have begun to talk about possibly taking her for surgery. Nobody has done anything. And I said to her, I said, ma'am, can you please, please just help us? At which point this woman looked me dead back in my eyes, snatched her hands away from me, and said to me words that still haunt me to this day. She said, sir, your wife just isn't a priority right now.
Wait.
Your wife just isn't a priority.
I was about to ask, you can't be serious, but I know you're not making this up, though, obviously.
No, I'm not. And it's 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock comes around. She's still there. She's still suffering, expressing pain, having more and more trouble staying awake. And 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and now it's after midnight. And it wasn't until 12:30 a.m. that they finally made the decision to take Kira back to surgery. As I mentioned earlier before the break, my son was born at 2 o'clock that afternoon. So now it's 10 hours later. 10 hours she's been there bleeding internally, suffering needlessly, while myself and my family beg and plead for them just to validate our concerns and take action, right? So now at this point, I'm frustrated, I'm angry, but part of me is relieved because they're finally doing something. So they mobilize her, they take her back to surgery, and I'm walking next to the bed, and she says to me, she's weak and she's in pain, but she's conscious and she's aware of everything that's going on. And keep in mind, as I told you earlier in this conversation, this is a woman that was fearless. And as we're making this walk to the operating room, she said something to me that I don't think I've ever heard her say. And she said to me, she said, baby, I'm scared. I'm scared. And once again, as a husband, you just do the best you can. I'm just telling her everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to be all right. And there's so many layers, and we'll get into this, but the greatest layer and the greatest failure for me, as I look back on this 8 years later, it was the failure of fundamental human decency. And the doctor who had been responsible for Kira's care, who had just kind of allowed this to take place, he overheard that conversation, her expressing her fears, and he said something else to me that haunts me this day. He said, it's not a big deal. He said, sometimes these things happen. I'm going to go back into the same incision I made for the cesarean section. I'm going to find out what's going on. I'm going to fix it, and she'll be back in 15 minutes. She'll be back in 15 minutes. And so finally we get to the end of this long corridor. The doors open, and they tell me I can't go any further. They said, sir, you've got to stay right here, and those doors close behind here. When they took her back in the operating room, Tavis, and they opened her up, there were 3 liters of blood in her abdomen, from where she'd been allowed to bleed and suffer for all those hours. And when they opened her up, she coded. Her heart stopped immediately. And they tried to work on her for some time, but they were unable to save her. And at 2:23 a.m. on the morning of April 13th, 2016, Kira Dixon Johnson was pronounced dead at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, California.
I don't know what to say, Charles.
Let me say this, Travis. You know, when I walk, I'm always transparent about this, right? Because at this point, 8 years later, I get a lot of props for the work that we've done and the things we've tried to accomplish in Kira's honor, right? But I always have to be transparent about the fact that when I walked into that hospital that afternoon, the thought that my wife would not walk out to raise her boys, it never crossed my mind, right? And I thought that I knew. I thought that I did everything right. I thought that I read all the books. I never missed a prenatal appointment for either one of my sons, right? I sought out the place that I thought would give her the best chance, right? And it still wasn't enough. It still wasn't enough. And what I didn't understand then, but what I understand now, is that Kira is not an anomaly. Is that we are in the midst of a maternal mortality crisis that is shameful across the board in our country, and that we lead the industrialized world in women dying in pregnancy and pregnancy-related causes. But what is even more disturbing than that is that our women, mothers from the African-American community, are dying at rates five times as often as their Caucasian counterparts. So we cannot have a substantive conversation about the maternal mortality crisis in the United States without head-on addressing the manner in which it is disproportionately affecting Black women and Black families, period, full stop.
Your son, Langston, is born at 2 p.m.
Yeah.
Your wife is pronounced dead at 2:23 a.m.
Yes, sir.
When they walk out to tell you that Kira is gone, what do you recall about that moment?
There's a couple of things. And in the interest of time, so like I said, it was after midnight, so my mother had taken my older son back to the condo. Kira's family had gone to check in the hotel, and I was the only one there. But when they took her back to surgery, they first came out and told me that she coded and that her situation was critical, but they were continuing to work on her. And my response at that time was, thank you for letting me know, but I need you to get back in there and bring me my wife back. And even though things were bad, I'm thinking to myself, this is Kira, right? Like, ain't no way. Like, she gonna be all right. It got a little sketchy, but this is the closest thing I was just talking to her, right? And so I called the family, and they rushed back up there. And so we're there just kind of all praying and pacing. And then another set of doctors came out. Very importantly, this is another thing I don't get to share often, is that the doctor who had been responsible for her care didn't even come out and give us the news, Tavis. He sent two residents out there to give us the news while he slipped out the back door. He sent two kids out there. Right? And I remember them saying that to us. And I remember everything. The best way I can describe it is almost like a nuclear bomb had been dropped upon everything that I hold dear. And I just remember, I'm still haunted by the sound, the scream that her mother made, right? I remember her just collapsing to the floor. I remember her brother shouting and screaming like, no, no, no. And I remember standing there frozen in disbelief. And I just watching everybody kind of in slow motion just crumble, like my whole world crumble around me.
I'm kind of frozen myself in disbelief. Give me a minute, Charles. We'll continue when we come forward.
Sounds different, huh? This is Travis Smiley. Smiley.
Charles Johnson IV. I'm getting stuff coming at me so fast I can't even keep up with it. Messages and posts and and all the like. Let me just ask a couple of questions that people want to know. Obviously, I want to know these things as well, because I know the backstory, because I've read about it and know your case, remember when it happened, and I've been at Cedars for a number of procedures in my own life, so I know this hospital quite well. Lived down the street from Cedars, in fact. Were there any black nurses, any black doctors, any black personnel that you recall that particular night that you spoke to or could have spoken to?
Yes, they were few and far between. Mm-hmm. There was a nurse that was an African-American woman who was actually part of our intake team, mm-hmm. Who was very kind, but she had a shift change, Davis. Mm-hmm. Shortly after Langston was born, she was gone. And I think from that point forward, I may have seen one other black face in all those hours.
Yeah. That question is asked, obviously, because we're just trying to figure out if there was anybody black to appeal to that might have understood the way that others did not. Clearly, this case became a major, this issue turned into a major legal case. Can you update me on the legal proceeding, the legal case?
Sure. So, you know, an effort from the onset, there have been two things that I've been very clear about that were important to me. And the only thing that ever mattered to me in this whole process has been transparency and accountability. One, what is it that happened to Kira? How did you let a woman that was in perfect health walk into your hospital and not walk out? And then secondarily, what is it that you are doing to make sure that this doesn't ever happen to anybody else? Mm-hmm. And sadly, Cedars refused to answer either of those questions. So I had to take matters into my own hands and move forward with a civil action. And Kira's, the action that we took actually, it's interesting, like, I vowed to take that place apart brick by brick. Mm-hmm. This should never happen in the layers of failure. And so what has happened is that in that process, Tavis, there were multiple Cedar Sinai employees who were whistleblowers who came forward to speak about what happened in Kira's case, mm-hmm. right? One of them, and I'll come back to them, but two of them were nurses, both involved in Kira's care. Not only did they speak to the failures, the systemic failures of procedural things that they failed Kira on, but they spoke specifically how Kira's race played a role in her care. Mm-hmm. Then they also spoke specifically to the broader issue of a culture of institutional racism within Cedars-Sinai. The testimony from those two brave individuals, one who was a Caucasian woman and then one who was an African-American woman, who was a part of Kira's care team, I did not see her, but she was in that. She was called in when Kira went back into that second surgery.
Yeah.
And they saw what happened, and they couldn't in good conscience move forward without sharing their story. That testimony, because now at this point, Tavis, is not just my account of what happened.
Yeah.
It is Cedars-Sinai employees speaking to this,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Those testimonies became the catalyst for a civil rights action that then became the catalyst. And this is what I want our listeners, particularly in the black community, to understand where we are going with this. And why this case is so important, not to our family, but for every single family in this country. That testimony became the catalyst for the Department of Health and Human Services to open up a federal civil rights investigation of the treatment of black women at Cedars-Sinai.
Hold that thought one second, Charles Johnson the Fourth. I'm up against the clock in our remaining moments. We will hear where that investigation is, where that investigation is headed, but this all happened because Charles Johnson the Fourth had to take matters into his own hands. You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Seeking the truth. Speaking the truth. This is the Tavis Smiley Show. Ready to re-examine your assumptions and expand your inventory of ideas? More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
I've got 4 short minutes left in this conversation. I want to do 3 things in 4 minutes. One, I asked earlier about how Langston and Charles the Fifth are doing, but I want to know how Charles the Fourth is doing all this time later. I want to hear, have him share about Cura for Moms, his nonprofit. But I want to start very quickly with the update on this investigation. Let's do those three things in 3 minutes. Charles, take it away.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you so much for having me. And so this investigation led by the Department of Health and Human Services into the civil rights of Black women at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. And so to bring this home for our community is this is the branch of the federal government that provides federal funding for hospitals. So when this investigation is concluded and when they establish this pattern of institutional racism, this hospital will no longer be eligible for federal funding. And so this will send a loud, definitive message to hospitals and health systems all over the country that if you are not taking steps to address systemic racism in your culture, yes, you are complicit and you will be held accountable to a different level.
Yes, yes, yes. For Cura for Moms, tell me about your nonprofit work.
Yes, sure. For Cura for Moms is an organization we founded in 501c3 that we founded in honor of Cura and every other mother that has made the ultimate sacrifice, given the gift of life. And we are committed to eradicating this maternal mortality crisis, full stop. We do this through education, advocacy, and legislation. So you can find out more about our organization at www.4cureformoms.com. And it's the number 4, K-I-R-A, the number 4, M-O-M-S, on all social media as well.
4Cura4Moms, the number 4.
Yes,
the number the 4. Number 4. Twice, exactly.
The number 4, yes, indeed.
And
yes,
finally, indeed. You did that quite nicely, brother. I thank you for moving through these 3 minutes. But I want to close. Yes, I want to close talking about you. You told us earlier that Langston is doing well, that Charles the Fifth is doing well. I want to know how Charles Johnson the Fourth is doing.
You know, honestly, I'll be real. You know, it goes back to my boys. You know, they saved my life. And although there's nothing that I can do to bring Cura back, the highest honor I can pay her is to do everything we can to send other mothers home with their precious babies and to make sure that we raise men that are consistent with the greatness that she wanted for her sons. And so that's what I do every single day, and it's an honor, and that's what keeps me going.
None of us, Charles Johnson IV, would ever want to be in your shoes. But sometimes God gives his toughest battles to his strongest soldiers. And obviously you fit that bill. And so thank you for your work and for your witness. Thank you for your transparency. Thank you for your truth. Thank you for sharing this story once again with this audience in this hour. And all the best to you, man. I'm just grateful. I'm deeply grateful, sir.
As am I for you. Thank you so much to you and your team. Looking forward to connecting again soon, brother. I appreciate you.